meeting of the Public Safety Committee will come to order. Representative Kiefer. Morning, Representative Kiefer. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 142 and ask that it be re-referred to Judiciary.
Representative Kiefer moves House File 142. There's some questions. All right. And his path will be to the committee. Representative Hillstrom's Committee on Judiciary. There was some confusion here in the beginning. Representative Kiefer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm honored to reintroduce this bill to the Public Safety Committee. I introduced this last year. It's been quite a few years in the running. It's a good bill. That's why we don't want to let it just disappear. It's a repeat offenders, it's the county attorney or prosecutor's ability to increase the penalty if there's a repeat offense on fifth degree charges of sexual offense. So these are what my county attorney, Pete Orpitt, would call the knuckleheads that keep doing these little silly things over and over and over again. This gives them another tool in the toolbox to hang over their head and say, stop doing this or we're going to slap you with a felony next time. So we hope that it's a way to prevent worse offenses down the road, and we think it would be a good way to stop this behavior and nip it in the bud, I'd like to say. Mr. Chair, there's a slight fiscal note on it. Would you like to talk about that first, or would you like to have questions on the bill?
Sure, why don't you talk about the fiscal note first?
Okay, Mr. Chair, there's a small fiscal note, and the courts got back to us and decided this year that there really wouldn't be any impact on court costs. The fiscal note, I want to just point out that in the language it says they may be sentenced. So again, this is not necessarily going to be a cost to the state, but it could potentially, if that person has to go into jail with the felony charge. Sorry. So that's kind of where the money comes from. I think most of you know I'm a fiscal conservative. I wouldn't be carrying this bill if it was going to be a huge cost to the state. I really, truly believe this is a preventative measure. And if we have to spend a little bit up front, I think it's going to save the money, the state money in the long run. Does anyone else have any questions about that particular issue of the bill?
Seeing none, you may proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chair, then I would like to introduce Erin Kuster. She's the county attorney, assistant county attorney for Goodhue County, and she knows a lot more about the details of the bill. And so if anyone has specific questions, I'd like Erin to address them.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Representative Seifert and members of the committee, my name is Erin Kuster, and I'm an assistant Goodhue County attorney, and it is really an honor and privilege to be here in front of you this morning. This is a bill that is really close to my heart and the prosecutors who prosecute sexual violence crimes throughout the state of Minnesota. We really strongly believe in this bill, because if you recall, you know, the communication or a conversation, I would say, about sexual violence has been evolving. I've been a prosecutor since 1997, and I've specialized in prosecuting crimes of sexual violence since 1999. And those crimes involve both children as victims as well as adults as victims. When I first began my job as a prosecutor, we didn't talk about sexual violence. What happened in the home stayed in the home. You know, people were shocked and awed about some of the crimes that were in the headlines. But now you can't open up your phone, you can't look on the internet, you can't read a newspaper, you can't turn on the TV without seeing the impact that sexual crimes have had in the community. And what has happened is this body, as well as the Senate, has responded to those types of crimes from the conversations that have happened in our communities. But what has been overlooked for years is this offense. Criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree, people look at it as something that's really not that significant. That's something that we really don't have to be concerned about. But if we let individuals repeatedly violate members of our communities over and over and over again, and the penalty does not increase, we are not doing our jobs. We are not protecting those individuals in our communities that most need the protection. This offense, this bill, would bring criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree in alignment with all of the other criminal sexual conduct statutes. Right now, this subdivision is treated differently. And it's quite honestly, it's a loophole in the criminal sexual conduct code, and it's been taken advantage of by individuals who are savvy enough to repeat violate against individuals in their most violent way down the line. They start small, just like in anything. You start pushing boundaries, and you start small. And if the penalty is not anything great, then you keep doing it until you get enough courage to do something more violent. I would encourage you to move for the passage and to pass this bill so that we can work together to end sexual violence, not only in the community that I prosecute, but in the communities that you represent. Thank you very much for your time. And I'd like to introduce Donna Doomer. Donna, who would like to say a few more comments about the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Donna Dunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I have very little to add, but a couple of comments that I would like to make. This measure came out of our Public Policy Committee, which is a multidisciplinary group, including prosecutors from really all across the state who have identified those places where we need to close loopholes, as Aaron Kuster so clearly said. And so we really are looking forward to this being one place where we have an opportunity to intervene at a lower level of offending rather than waiting until we are at a place where somebody gets a prison sentence or comes into the prison system, when in fact maybe an early intervention could have stopped another victimization as well as some more serious crime. So we are very supportive of looking at ways we can intervene earlier in offending behavior, and this really fits into our view of how we can behave in some ways that are preventative in terms of responding to sexual violence. In addition to being enhanced by repetitions of the same crime, a fifth-degree crime, somebody who is convicted of done a fifth-degree level crime, but who also has a prior conviction or has a subsequent conviction of some other crimes would also bring forth the enhancement. This would also come into play for somebody who is soliciting a minor, was communicating with a minor with sexually explicit materials, using a minor in sexual performance. So it also would bring in a number of other a series of other criminal activities that could in fact enhance then a subsequent fifth degree. So we see it as being very useful for repeat fifth degree offenses as well as other offenses that could be in the record of somebody who is also committing fifth degree offenses. We really look for your support. We see that this might in fact be a way to intervene early and stop behavior that could in fact escalate. Thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kiefer, for bringing this bill. I sit on the Crow Wing County Sexual Assault Services Board and have been on it for, 12 years now, And each year, I have seen the number of cases and the number of sexual assaults escalate and intensify and become very much problematic in our society, in my area, and I'm assuming around the whole state of Minnesota. And I know as an educator that through early intervention that we can, the earlier we try to intervene, the more likelihood that maybe we can make an impact, make a positive impact. So I would strongly support this bill. I thank you for bringing it forward, Representative Kiefer, and And thank you for bringing us, making this awareness to all of us in on this committee. Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Is there anybody? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this bill has to ultimately end up in my committee, but I think it was Representative Paymar's intention to lay the bill over for possible inclusion and then to send his entire bill through the Judiciary Committee. I don't think it matters either way as long as this provision ultimately ends up in the Judiciary Committee.
Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays the bill over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Kiefer.
Thank you.
Representative Simons, would you like to move the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Done. Okay, next, I think we're going to have an overview from our fiscal analyst, John Waltz.
Mr. Chair, members, there's been some discussion, I guess some level of frustration from members about detail and budget information. I had a conversation with the chair, and I'm going to try to put together a spreadsheet that will have an additional level of detail for all of the agency's budget requests than is currently included in the budget books. But included in your packet is a spreadsheet that I had prepared for the chair at his request when he wanted to see some of the actions that had been taken in recent years. And I don't intend to take up too much of the committee's time. But I told the chair that I could run through this spreadsheet. And so if everyone has a copy, essentially what it is history of the actions of this committee over the last three biennia. And so just to go over how one would look at this spreadsheet, if starting on the first page, we have the Department of Corrections. And the program at the in the top box is institutions, and this would be all the correctional facilities in the state. If you see the shaded area from line 8 to line 16, these were actions, either additions or subtractions, to the institution's budget made in the 2007-2008 legislative sessions for the fiscal 2008-2009 biennium. 2007 was essentially the last year where the state was running a surplus and additions were made as a general rule to agencies' budgets. And so you see there were several additions for increase in health services, increase in fuel and utilities, retiree insurance, and so forth. The following year, there was a deficit, the second year of that biennium, and you start to see some cuts being made to different agencies and program areas. From line 17 to 22, you'd see the following biennium. There's a shaded box, and it will show additions that were made to agencies and any corresponding cuts. So there were reductions on line 19. For efficiencies that the department had found that they could take advantage of. There were some short-term violator reductions and an agency-wide reduction. And again, the next shaded box from line 23 to line 27 would be for the biennium after that, any reductions or additions that were made. I will just add, on line 23, it looks like there was a major addition made to the institutions area. This was actually putting money back in the agency's budget for a mistake in the language of the previous biennium's bill that would have shorted the agency for this $27 million. So essentially that's not a major addition. That's to make them whole for a mistake that was made. But if you look at the bottom of this sort of box for the institutions on line 34, you see that in 2008 The final appropriation for institutions was $323 million. And you can track this over the years. In 2009, it went up to 336, then started to be reduced to 332, a little bit more in 11 to 335, in 12 down to 327, in 13 to 328. And so you can follow any area that we have under our purview, how it's changed over the last several years. And without going over this line by line, that's just essentially what the spreadsheet would show on the actions made over the last three biennia, and you can track any program area, how it's either increased or decreased over the years. And if there's any specific questions, I can answer them, but that's the extent of the information that that was requested to be put in the packets.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to commend staff. This is really a great step in the right direction, giving us some good hard figures on this and drilling down on some of these costs. So thank you very much.
Any other questions from members? Seeing none, we will proceed to our overview of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And while they're getting ready, I went on the tour the other day, and if any member has not gone to see their operation, I strongly urge you to go. It is phenomenal. Superintendent, welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Wade Setter. I'm the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, we've been asked to provide an overview of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I know that we had some conversations yesterday, some questions, and I would expect many more today. I'll provide the overview and certainly entertain questions at the Chair's discretion as we move forward. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the BCA was established by the legislature in 1927. It became a division of the Department of Public Safety in 1969. And the purpose that the BCA was created and we still serve today is for the purpose of assisting Minnesota law enforcement with the identification and apprehension of criminals. Our mission statement, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension protects Minnesotans and all who visit our state by providing services to prevent and solve crime in partnership with law enforcement, public safety, and other criminal justice agencies. And the point I would really like to emphasize here is the partnership component, as we discussed yesterday. Our authority of our law enforcement section under the statute is our special agents have the same authority as a county sheriff, so they're fully sworn to enforce all state laws. But where we really, I think, leverage our success is by working in partnership with local agencies and supporting them. We're organized through four divisions: our Investigations Division, Forensic Science Services, which is the state crime laboratory, Minnesota Justice Information Services, that's the criminal justice information and integration, and then Criminal Justice Training and Education. We have approximately 350 employees, and the majority of our employees are located in the St. Paul headquarters that some of you were able to visit the other day on Maryland Avenue that was built 10 years ago. And we have agents deployed in 10 field offices around the state of Minnesota. The yellow dots represent that. And it's a little tough to see, but up in Beltrami County, which is the city of Bemidji, we have a regional lab and regional office up there where we have a smaller version of our St. Paul lab to serve our partners in the northern half of the state of Minnesota. From the Investigations Division, really our charge is to provide expertise, leadership, and technology to solve serious crime. And in the past year, some of the cases that received some notoriety that we were directly involved in, there was a Native mob gang investigation that occurred up in northern Minnesota. It's one of the first, in fact, the first federal racketeering-influenced corrupt organization, federal prosecution in the state of Minnesota. We arrested approximately 30 violent offenders, solved two homicides, both in the city of Minneapolis, as a matter of fact, and that case is ongoing. A majority of those defendants have pled guilty. You may have remembered down in Faribault about August or September, the revelation of a sex abuse case that was approximately 10 years old at Shattuck St. Mary's. We were involved in that and had agents in collaboration with the Sheriff's Department and the Faribault Police Department throughout the country conducting that investigation. The Officer Tom Decker case, that tragic event that occurred in December up in Cold Springs, we were critical in working with Stearns County and in the city of Cold Springs in helping bring that case to a resolution. There's many more cases, but just giving oversight of the type of cases we directly involved in are typically major investigations that involved serious allegations of crimes against person. Forensic Science Services, we are the only full-service accredited forensic laboratory in Minnesota. As we've discussed briefly yesterday with some of the discussion that's been taking place in the courts with regard to forensic science and the running of laboratories, we frequently measure turnaround time, how fast we take evidence in, and then be able to produce a report on the analysis as being paramount, but the reality of it is the quality control is paramount, and that's what accreditation brings to the table. The ability to get the evidence admitted into court through the legal process is absolutely critical. And so even though a turnaround time, I can tell you the 80-plus scientists we have in our lab frequently use that as a measurement because it gives us some idea of how we're able to serve our customers faster and better. It is not the premier standard that we should be judging labs by. Minnesota Justice Information Services, or MINJIS as we refer them, is really about the integration of criminal justice information, and it helps law enforcement, corrections courts, probation, all those folks involved in the criminal justice process try to make better decisions about how to deal with a particular offender. As you just heard earlier from the bill that was introduced, information is paramount for the prosecutor courts and ultimately corrections, and to make sure we're providing the absolute best solution to whatever the challenge they're facing. We provide over 30-plus systems and services to the criminal justice community in the state of Minnesota. Many of those are background services. It's a technology-driven section. But some of the services, the top 10 that we provide, are criminal history, electronic fingerprinting, the law enforcement message switch, which is a connection between law enforcement and with the FBI, integrated search service, the ability to search across systems to find where an individual might have a record, e-charging, a relatively new development with us with the DataMaster breath testing system, where we can take and electronically transmit records in real time as an individual is processed for impaired driving. Comprehensive incident-based reporting service, or CYBRS, is a technology we provide, crime reporting, providing FBI crime reports to the federal government and to our local partners so they have some understanding what crimes occurring in our community. Predatory offender registry, Minnesota repository of arrest photos. Those are booking photos for anyone that's booked in a detention facility in the state of Minnesota. And then the permit tracking system, which has to do with gun permits. Criminal justice training and education. Our goal there is to provide cost-effective access to high-quality criminal justice training to law enforcement professionals throughout the state of Minnesota. As you noticed, for those of you on the tour the other day, our building was full. We had several classes going on. The parking at those peak points of time, as you experienced, is not always the most accessible. We make do with what we can. But we provide training to about 6,000 law enforcement professionals throughout the state of Minnesota. And that training is in areas from technical classes and maybe in crime scene photography or crime scene processing, all the way up through management leadership training, breath testing, certification, and so forth. In the original direction from the committee several weeks ago, some of the things we were asked to talk about is some of our challenges. And I've been with the BCA for approximately a year and a half. I was appointed by Commissioner Doman and come from a local law enforcement perspective. And one of the challenges I think we have in any organization is developing performance measurement processes to really drive strategic decision making. In this day and age, we need to make sure we maximize the results from the resources we have, and data is the component of that that helps make those decisions. We also have to do that in context of the growing needs of the criminal justice community and operating within those existing resources. We've been working with our customers, our constituents at the local level to provide input in helping us establish those priorities. And went through, we're in the midst of a strategic planning process that will be concluded by May. We gathered feedback from our internal employees, gathered it from an external stakeholder group, including legislators were invited. And some of the emerging themes that came out of that is greater awareness of what we do and the value that we add. Not everybody understands what the BCA does, and part of that is because we work in partnership, so it's not always apparent when we're involved in a case or an investigation. They tend to understand things about maybe the lab, if they have that experience, investigative services, or MINJIS. Some of these things are in the background, and we need to make sure everybody is aware that we do add value. And also they expect us to continue as leaders in criminal justice community and really be nimble in anticipating and responding to emerging trends, such things as financial crimes, cybercrime. A number of years ago, the legislature funded Internet Crimes Against Children Unit in our section, in our division that helps us work on the trafficking of child pornography as one example. Hot topics, integration and use of data with criminal justice while balancing privacy needs. That's always a challenge for us, I think, in the criminal justice community. That we live in a society that's data-driven. The use of mobile technology, the ability to gather data is constantly growing. The demand is there, and we always have to be sensitive to the privacy needs and what is that criminal justice purpose for that information, how is it best and appropriately used. Lab accreditation and turnaround time. We are accredited, our lab is accredited by the American Society of Crime Lab Directors, ASCLAD, which is one of the premier accreditation organizations in the world. And so that is a high priority for us. It's we're, I believe, reaccredited every 5 years. It's an ongoing process. But then always trying to ensure that we have the best turnaround time within our resources. As was discussed, I believe, by Representative Lesh yesterday, that the longer it takes for us to get evidentiary samples back to a prosecutor or law enforcement agency, the more difficult it is to prosecute them, and we are sensitive to that. I already mentioned cybercrime, financial crimes as kind of those emerging trends. As the access to technology and the Internet grows, the borders in which a law enforcement agency may have to conduct an investigation become far more complex. Crossing political jurisdictions is a huge challenge, and even some cases end up in an international venue because of the Internet. Synthetic controlled substances, and I believe on the 27th you're having an informational hearing on the impact of synthetic controlled substances. We'll have some of our lab folks here as a resource, but that is an ongoing challenge for not only law enforcement, the criminal justice system, but for our laboratory as well. It's very complex, and the solutions are not readily apparent. Mr. Chair, I'd transition into some of our change items in this year biennial budget, if at your discretion. The first thing I'd like to talk about is forensic laboratory staffing. And I'd also point out that I believe you've all received this folder today, which has a fact sheet in each one of these to kind of summarize some of the highlights of these particular initiatives. Our staffing has remained relatively steady within the laboratory, and of course submissions climbed. Just one example, as you can see, with the blood and urine tests, and these are blood and urine tests for the presence of alcohol or a controlled substance. In 2006 we were seeing about 550 a month, and in 2010 1267 a month. I mean, just an understanding of how the growth is just significantly creating a demand in our services. Crimes against person evidence is up 8% from 2010 to 2011. Better staffing enables us to better meet the needs of our local partners, whether it's in the prosecution or law enforcement sections. And I would also suggest the defense fire has an invested interest in this, too. And one of the things we were able to do with our strategic planning is we were able to bring the chief public defender to the table, because we realized that, in particularly the science area, it's neutral. Our organization is committed to the pursuit of justice regardless of where that answer takes us. And that means exonerating folks that are perhaps inappropriately accused of a crime as well. One of the challenges that you saw in the tour and we discussed briefly yesterday is the lab equipment that we have in our agency. In the last year, we've done an assessment of the lifespan of the equipment, and we have approximately $7 million of equipment that's at or beyond its expected life expectancy. Where that creates a challenge for us is in our ability to replace and repair that equipment proactively. For example, right now we have two instruments, only two, that allow us to do a type of testing that tells us the purity of a controlled substance, cocaine or methamphetamine. We don't use it a lot. We use it primarily in federal cases. Both of those happen to be down right now. And so the ability to get specialized equipment repaired is a challenge for us in terms of timing. We have a federal case that's due that's coming up for trial on the 19th of next month, and so we're kind of scrambling figuring that out. And that's because we just don't have the resources to have a replacement plan that is periodic, so we can avoid these types of things. Obsolete technology, just like the computer on your desk, the smartphone on your pocket, many of these pieces of equipment use personal computers. The technology evolves over time, and of course the latest and greatest tends to increase efficiency and effectiveness, and we're just not in a position to be very proactive with that. We have used robotics, as many of you have seen, to try and enhance and leverage our human resources. The greater use of robotics in doing analysis is one of those things that helps us tend to reduce the number of scientists we need, because some of these devices can be loaded with 100 samples that might run over 12 or 24 hours, and then the human intervention for the actual analytic component occurs at a later time. We don't have to have a scientist standing next to the machine. We're looking at replacement. Right now, our current replacement budget's $125,000 a year. It's $250,000 a biennium. We're looking to double that to just give us the ability to become a little more proactive, not only deal with short-term needs, but become more strategic in our replacement.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to take you back to the use of robotics and, you know, having 100 samples. So then how, you know, as then a prosecutor who then needs to prove that, in fact, the sample that you had matches the result that you saw, how do you take care of that, you know, chain of custody issue or the, you know, the issue the defense might raise of, is that really the sample that was in there, and how do you really know if there were 100 samples in the tube?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's a very good question, and that really comes back to the use of the computer technology that manages the samples. And one of the, I think, real advantages of accreditation is each one of those steps is documented and recorded. So we do create the chain of custody, and you're right to ensure that this sample belongs to this case, which is tracked to this defendant. That's critical, and clearly we wouldn't be able to admit these cases in court if we wouldn't do that. That is part of the entire technology, so when we have a robotic, it's a component of a larger system. So all of those records exist, and any changes, the reagents that are used sometimes in the chemical analysis, their history has to be tracked as well. So it's a comprehensive system.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how long have you been using the robotics in the system, and has it resulted in any court challenges to the information?
Sorry, Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. You're pushing me right to the edge, Madam Representative. I have Frank Dolish, our lab director here. I can tell you it's not used in every piece of equipment we have, because we have about a dozen different sections in the lab, but Mr. Dolish would be able to answer that question.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Frank Dolish. I'm the lab director at the BCA. Representative Hillstrom, the in some areas we've been using robotics for a long time. For example, with blood alcohols, we've had robotic equipment to do blood alcohols for probably 15, 20 years. In other areas, like in our DNA group, the robotics, the types of robotics that we use are more recent, probably in the last 2 or 3 years. And if we hadn't deployed this type of technology, we would be swamped years ago with cases, because it really does make us more effective and efficient. You asked a question about how do we keep track of samples and how do we track them. All of these things are barcoded, and the computer tracks all of that. And as the superintendent mentioned, we track everything, and all of this has been subjected to testimony and courtroom in cases all over the state, and we have not been challenged on that, to my knowledge, successfully at all.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Serra, you said something a couple slides ago about an upcoming trial, a federal trial, and this has me questioning kind of the burden-sharing arrangement between you and the feds. I've taken a 2-year holiday from this committee, and I know this came up before when I was on this committee, but I can't recall. So when you have a case in federal court, I would have thought that maybe you'd get some help with some of these issues from the FBI. But is it a question of whose agents brought the case? In other words, why are you doing the work for a federal trial as opposed to the feds? Is it that it's Minnesota folks or local law enforcement that basically brought the case as opposed to federal law enforcement? Is that why you're doing that? Or how does that work in terms of the splitting up the workload?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, a great question. In that particular case, the Native Mob prosecution that's taking place right now, we have an agent, one of our BC agents, assigned to a federal task force up in the Bemidji area called the Safe Trails Task Force. And so we provide the FTE, the body, to that task force. They provide some expenses in terms of overtime, administrative support, and it's an FBI local. And there's other local agencies that are involved in that. In that particular case, it's the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms that are partners. It's not just us taking the case. One of the challenges we always have in the law enforcement community is when you start an investigation, you don't always know at what threshold it's going to be prosecuted. And frequently, when it rises to the federal threshold, the investigation takes to that point, there is always a federal partner that's associated with it. So it's not us doing it independently. It's, again, us doing it in partnership with federal and other local partners.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
So just to follow up, just as a hypothetical, let's say there was a case that originated in, say, Beltrami County. And for whatever reason, the U.S. Attorney's Office decided to take the case and bring it in federal court as opposed to a county attorney bringing it in state court. Would you then be involved in that case because it originated in Beltrami County, or no? At that point, would the FBI take care of it? Or is it just, does it just depend on the case?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, it does depend on the case. If we were not involved in it from the beginning, and it was, for example, an FBI-led investigation, we would most likely would not be involved. But if it was a case that started out as a drug case, for example, or a homicide case that ultimately ended in some organized criminal enterprise investigation, theoreticals are difficult, of course, but it would not be unusual for us to then bring the federal government through the FBI or ATF or even DEA in some cases to the plate and working jointly with them.
Okay. Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Setter, I'm going back to the blood and urine testing numbers. Have we decreased those numbers with the advent of the Data Master breath testing? And if so, by how much since we had the intoxilizer that we all but quit using for 2 years, and now we have the machine that's up fully functional and acceptable again?
Superintendent Setter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, what you're referring to is the intoxilizer source code lawsuit from about 4 or 5 years ago, and what that did is essentially eliminated the use of the intoxilizer as an instrument while that was in litigation. As a component of our partnership with the Office of Traffic Safety, we identified a new instrument, the Data Master, which is we just completed rollout of it this September, as a matter of fact, this past September. And during the source code, when the intoxilizer wasn't being used, our blood and urine tests did grow exponentially. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I'd be happy to provide them for you, but it seems to me it was more than double what you might see here. As we've implemented the Data Master over the last year, we're starting to see dramatic reductions in that, and of course that becomes important because we're taking the burden of testing off at the arresting officer point through the use of the Data Master, and we shift some of the burden back off of our lab. So we've kind of been through the bubble, and we're recovering from that.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, in your budget you have a $125,000 annual fund appropriation for BCA lab equipment, the budget to replace the worn and outdated equipment. Could you explain why there's another $125,000 out of the truck highway fund that's out of the jurisdiction of the Transportation Committee?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the reason for that would be is the trunk highway funding is used for some of these breath and chemical testing. It's from driving impaired cases, that would make it eligible for the use of trunk highway fund, trying to leverage the value out of that particular asset. It's for DWI enforcement, basically.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now that you're using the Data Master and now that that is being challenged and that we have a whole new series of cases, do you anticipate that it'll go back up in terms of your testing that the BCA has to do?
Superintendent Setter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not aware that we have any significant challenges. Of course, there's always going to be defense challenges to new technology. I'm not aware, my staff is here to correct me if I'm wrong. But we are proceeding, and I can tell you just from the numbers we've seen on a monthly basis, the use of it is growing, and it has not been overturned or challenged to the point of we're not able to use it in court.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, I noticed, too, in your budget, we're looking to increase staffing in the lab, hire some more scientists and things like that. Two questions. Number one, rather than hire scientists, is it possible to use technicians in some of this testing? in terms of, I mean, levels of expertise and things like that for running standard tests?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglem, I think if we just reflect on the last 6 or 8 months and some of the legal challenges we're seeing with using non-scientific persons in a non-accredited laboratory as a challenge. The ASCLAD standards are very important because they provide not only quality control but lab standards that are necessary in order to reduce the opportunity for a defense challenge on the admissibility of a piece of forensic evidence. Scientists, I don't think all of our scientists have a physical science background.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the drug chemistry section, where we have two of our additions, it takes approximately 12 months to 18 months to train one of those scientists in order to be qualified as an expert witness. I don't know if that answers the question. Ms. Dolish is here.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Representative Uglem.
I guess a little bit more background on that. I mean, you're running, you know, the same test time and time again on the same equipment, I'm sure following the scientific method and chain of evidence and everything else. But so we feel that it's very important to have a fully degreed scientist doing this rather than a trained technician.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dolish.
Representative, the answer to your question in short is yes. It is extremely important to have fully trained scientists. We just to clarify, we do use lab technicians where we can. We have staff, for example, that takes in evidence and receipts it from departments, that takes a big load off of the time that our scientific staff has to be involved and frees them up to actually be able to do caseworks. And even though that it may seem that a lot of these cases are very simple and straightforward, when you get into court, believe me, it's not simple and straightforward anymore. And that's really why we have to have scientists there to be able to testify and know about the technology they're using, why they're using it, how it works. And so we're always looking at ways to do things as economical as we can. That's why we're using robotics as well, is to try to maximize our FTE.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just also wanted to add that every single person that touches that sample, you have to subpoena for court. And so you want to have as few of people involved in the chain of custody, because at any given time a defendant can challenge the chain of custody and then have to bring in every single person that's touched it. And so the better they can do to streamline that process, and the fewer people, the fewer staff we're going to have out subpoenaed to go to court every single day.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to withdraw my question.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you. Mr. Dolan. I'm proud I finally, after many years, was able to pronounce your name, because I don't look at what's printed in letters. 2 years ago, I worked with you a lot on that, all the new chemical compounds bill, and then last year, Barrett carried it as the author. And what I'm wondering about is, how is that working out? And some of the issues I remember were prosecutors not using anything that was in the law. We changed some language there. Is that working? Another one was change some language on your ability to declare new substances. How is that working? Do you analyze new compounds that come in to see if they're something that would be a drug, having drug effects that are bad? Is that done in your laboratory? And how overall is that adding to costs, that whole? I know we're faced with huge problems, but is that adding to costs quite a bit or not?
Mr. Dolish.
Chairman, Representative Mulry, I'm glad that someone can pronounce my name. That's great. You asked a number of different questions, so I'm going to I'll maybe bounce around on some of this.
That's okay.
And so the synthetic drugs have impacted our ability to do these cases quickly. They're more complex. They take us a lot more time. And because we usually don't have standards or knowns for these things, it also gets to be fairly expensive for us. I think that a lot of the things that were included in the bill last year are working quite well. But I will tell you that about probably a week after the bill passed and became effective, we were seeing new compounds that weren't included in the bill. So I think we had maybe three or four right off the bat. And I think we'll probably be covering a lot more of this when you have that hearing. I don't remember what the date was.
27th.
To talk about these synthetics. So I'll have some staff here that can talk a little bit more about it. I haven't talked to the pharmacy board. They're the ones that have the new authority to be able to list these compounds, and I'm not sure where they're at with trying to include them by rule. And that was the other change that was made, and I guess I'd have to ask them how that's working for them. I haven't had a chance to talk to them recently about that.
Well, Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up.
Representative Mullery.
I guess that worries me that there's not much closer relationship between the two, your agency and the pharmacy board. I would think would anytime anybody took a step anywhere, there'd be immediate contact, because what they do would hopefully be in effect the next day in your office, and if you see something, hopefully it would be acted on right away by them.
We,
Mr. Dolish,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulry, we have communicated with them whenever we see these compounds. They also get information from local law enforcement that are seeing things out there. I have to apologize. I just haven't had a recent conversation with the executive director of the pharmacy board on what they're doing at this particular time, and we'll have that for you by that next meeting.
Thank you, Superintendent Setter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, I'd like to transition over from the lab to the MNJA section and talk about two significant budget requests that were in the governor's budget. The first one, the crime reporting system replacement. It's $4.5 million over two biennia, including ongoing costs. This may make more sense to you is the crime reporting system is the crime data that comes from a local law enforcement agency is reported to the state of Minnesota through the BCA and ultimately to the FBI and shows up in what's called the FBI Uniform Crime Report. Minnesota also puts out an annual crime report based on by individual jurisdiction. It's crime statistics. It's a summary data system, and what that means is we report summary data but not specific crime data, and there's a newer technology and mechanism that some states have moved to called the National Incident-Based Recording System, or NIBRS. I know there's a lot of acronyms in here, and I've had to memorize them myself, so there won't be a test, I promise you. But the which gives you just far more greater detail. And a great example would for that particular technology would be if I have a homicide that occurs and there was a drug crime and a sexual assault crime under the existing system of a summary system, I would only report the most serious offense, which would be the murder. Under the National Incident-Based Recording System, I would report the homicide, the sexual assault, and the drug crime. So, in fact, at the local level and even on a national level, we have a far greater understanding of really the scope and magnitude of the crimes in our communities. The current system includes instant arrest and property data. One of the challenges we have with this system and this particular system, I believe, is, I get confused, one's 40 years old and one is 20 years old. This system is 40 years old. And so, as we all know, technology has advanced dramatically. It's a legacy system. It's not easily amenable to any modification or interface. Some of the reports that we have been required to report on an annual basis, either by statute or by federal requirement, is law enforcement officers killed or injured in the line of duty, bias-motivated crime, pursuit crimes, firearms discharge, and employee counts. We have to create supplemental mechanisms within the system to even do that. And so it's very labor-intensive because we're not able to do it in an automated fashion because of the data technology. I could tell you in my previous life as a police chief, this was a critical report because I think it was a clear measurement of what's going on in our community as well as what's going on in other like-sized community and neighboring communities. So local officials, whether it's the city council, county board, police chief or sheriff, can make decisions about how to address some of those. I've covered some of this. It's obsolete technology. We do have a risk of failure, and that risk of failure could be significant. I don't know the programming language, but I know it's one that's very difficult to find folks that even have the programming skills to maintain. We cannot make easy changes to it. If the legislature or the federal government were to require a greater detailed reporting, we would have to go in and modify the system with one of these other supplemental systems, and so it becomes a challenge for us and very labor-intensive. This would allow us to transition towards an incident-based reporting or the NIBR system, as I mentioned, over the long run, and I think as a strategy for the criminal justice community, give us far better details as we move forward into what's really going on in our communities so we can develop either law enforcement, criminal justice, or social strategies to address them. And having more accurate, timely, and complete crime data, I think, gives all of us as policymakers the opportunity to deploy future resources more effectively. Mr. Chair, the criminal history replacement system is 20 years old. This is $11 million over two biennia, plus some ongoing expenses. This is a statewide system of arrest, court disposition, and custody data. There's a lot of data dissemination rules. This is some of the most sensitive data we have. Right now in this system, we have about 2.3 million adult arrests, about 71,000 juvenile arrests, and there's over 2 million law enforcement queries a year just in the state of Minnesota. It's used for investigations, critical decisions, charging, sentencing, release, bail, enhancements on criminal charges. It also becomes important because a lot of this data is utilized in making housing decisions, background checks, employment decisions, and so forth. So the need for it to be accurate is absolutely critical because we would not have somebody have some sort of economic or personal impact as a result of inaccurate data. Obsolete technology, again, being 20 years old, it's not amenable to change or integration. It's difficult to make changes as the statutory process or business process changes. We automate many manual processes as well, which, of course, is more labor-intensive and delays time, timely reporting criminal history data. Mr. Chair, for those of you at the BCA the other day, you saw just a brief overview of the live scan machine, and what this is a device. There's about 177 of them in the state of Minnesota at jails and police departments that book criminals that have been arrested. And it essentially is a scanner for your fingerprints. It does optical scanning of fingerprints and immediately reports that data to our systems at the BCA. This becomes very important because in the old days when I was a young police officer many, many years ago, everything was done on ink cards. And so you have quality control issues when you manually ink a fingerprint of a suspect or a criminal. It's sent then to the state. The state would have to classify that and then try to do manual comparisons. That could sometimes take weeks or even months in order to get an accurate identification of someone. This now happens in literally seconds or minutes. And it's really critical when you are booking someone who has used a false identity and they're in the system before, we're able to correct that early on rather than have them go through the entire process. It also becomes very important for us, and this was a critical part, and we'll talk a minute about the suspense files, which there's been some discussion about recently in the media, about tying a criminal history or an arrest event to a particular individual. Again, it's important for this data to be accurate so somebody is not unfairly sanctioned for an arrest that's not them. Sometimes people use different names or aliases, not unusual for siblings, for minor offenses to do that. I've had that experience myself. So this helps us with fingerprints to actually have accurate data. About 160,000 fingerprints are submitted a year to us from our local partners. About 99% of those are done through LifeScan now, so this has been a significant enhancement. The maintenance of these machines, the maintenance contract is about $1.5 million over two biennia. We provide these to local agencies at no cost and have historically done it for 10 or 15 years. And so now we need to ensure that this is ongoing, because if we don't, what's going to happen if they discontinue the use of these, we start with the ink cards again, which of course creates a ripple effect throughout the entire system and would certainly create problems with us in a whole host of ways. This the original funding was a state commitment, was a state project. We incur the maintenance costs after the warranty, and we're just seeking funding to offset those ongoing maintenance costs. The suspense files, and this is one of those components. Law enforcement by statute required to submit booking information with fingerprints to us within 24 hours. Clearly, the live scan devices allow us to do that almost in real time. So it's a time saving at the local level and certainly for us too. Courts are also required to submit disposition information. So once an individual is arrested, goes through the prosecution, ends up in court, we need to track this case from the beginning all the way through the process, all the way through the corrections process or public probation process. Suspense occurs when some of this information from courts through MNSIS or from our system or from the agency don't match, because again, we have to ensure that this offense is tied to a particular individual and it's the same person because of the potential consequences for having a criminal history. Right now, approximately 7% of the records are in suspense, which is a number of about 168,000 of that 2.1 million that you we discussed in the previous slide. 10 years ago, that was 40%. We credit the live scan as being one of the critical technologies in helping us really accurately reduce the suspense files. We've received these records since 1990, and once a record is detected in our system to go into suspense, in other words, the system thinks this arrest may belong to this person, but we're not sure because the data doesn't match, our technicians then contact the local agency, let them know that, and then provide them with whatever technical assistance that they require in order to bring the record out of suspense. The FBI's background check system, and this is probably a little bit of a misnomer, what it really is a National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS, that is run by the FBI. This is the one we talk about, and I know in some of the discussions you've had with regard to the firearms issues over the past a week or so of hearings. We actually, what that system does is it draws from two different repositories. The criminal history system that we report to the FBI is then queried by NICS when somebody applies for a permit to purchase or a permit to carry a handgun. They go through the NICS system and then looks for warrants, people, and property. And then the NICS system has state and federal disqualifiers if you're a prohibited person. This system, we do not actually own this system. It's not in our facility. We provide nothing more than an electronic pass-through for when the query is made by a local agency or a firearms dealer. It goes through our switch to the federal system that's run by the FBI.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you provide data uploads then to that based on these convictions that you talk about, and then as you fix these suspense files, are those also being uploaded as well?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes, we do. What happens is we provide the data through the criminal history system to the FBI, and then the NICS system directly queries that system at the federal level. So that request doesn't actually go through us, but it's not part of our data, at least at our location. But it's the same data.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then do you play any role in the mental health designations as well when someone's been civilly committed or any of that?
Superintendent Setter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, a perfect segue. Thanks for the softball there. Actually, as some of the discussions that have been out in the public domain and in the media about how this system works, they're not always accurate. The mental health data is actually maintained by the Department of Human Services. And so what happens is we have a mechanism, a query that runs through our systems where an individual, an agency, a sheriff's department, police department issuing a permit would make a query, and it would run and essentially query the DHS systems. They would get a report back that there's a possible connection or hit is what we call it, and then that agency would contact the Department of Human Services to ensure it's the right person or maybe not be the right person. Maybe a similar name or whatever. That's their responsibility to make that decision. The interesting thing about the civil commitment records, the DHS system has only been in effect since 2010, and I think it's one of these slides. We've only been providing data for civilly committed to state systems since 2010 through this system. Historical data is not active in this system, but it's available through a direct contact with the Department of Human Services. And it only, and if there are commitments that are made at the district court level to a private facility, the district court may or may not report them. They should report them, but they don't always do that. So the mental health issue is a real challenge for us on a national level with this particular technology. I know there's a lot of conversation about it, but it's not a perfect system. Minnesota is only one of 14 states in the country that provides any mental health data through the NICS system. So we are far ahead of our peers, but as a society, we have a long ways to go on that particular issue.
Thank you.
Okay, I think I've covered that. The other thing about background checks that for the law enforcement section that is helpful to understand is the sheriffs and police departments, they're the ones making that decision about whether or not to issue a permit based on the application. We provide the data. Their record systems are typically part of that check. They should be checking their record systems. They would check the Minnesota criminal history, which has wanted persons and criminal records, the FBI records checks, which is the NICS system, and DHS commitment information. That's how you'd run it at the local level. In 2004, we built this transaction. I think it's a QDPC, I think, or QDPG. Don't hold me to that. That helps facilitate that process. But the system is not perfect because we're crossing systems and trying to query disparate data. Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is that the same process that a private gun dealer who has to run that background check then uses? Do they then get each and every one of those separate searches as well?
Superintendent Setter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm going to invite Katie Engler, who is our senior legal analyst that knows this system inside and out, to answer those detailed questions for you.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, Katie Engler with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Representative Hillstrom, your question was about what a federally licensed firearm dealer does. They go directly to the FBI's NICS unit for their query. They do not come through the Bureau. But they're hitting the same repositories that the superintendent described when he talked about the NICS function at the FBI.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So they search the DHS commitment information, and they search our criminal background checks.
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, no. They make their query to the FBI's NICS unit. NICS, in their NICS index, has court orders from Minnesota since the end of September 2010 for civil commitments. That's the information that they have available to them. They do not have access to the Minnesota Department of Human Services index of historical civil commitments.
Thank you, Superintendent. Sorry, Representative Ward.
So help me here, just educate me. I often hear Representative Cornish and others talk about, you know, problems with the background checks related to purchasing a firearm or permit to carry or whatever. So, and you referenced that earlier in your testimony, Mr. Superintendent. Is there a fix for backgrounds for mentally ill or criminals? Or, and Representative Cornish, I don't know if I'm asking it appropriately. Maybe you can help me with this. What can the BCA do, or what can, you know, is there a, we sat here last week, through a few hours of testimony and heard that over and over again, so I'll just ask you, is there a fix?
Superintendent, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I mean, it is a challenge. I think, as you've seen, it's not a simple process, and there's disparate systems, data systems here across not only state agencies, but federal agencies, intrastate for folks from other states. Not every state has the same data available. I don't know that there's a simple fix, and clearly working towards the integration of data is probably the best solution. And as you've seen, that's one of the things, for example, our criminal history system, why that's very important for us, is so we get accurate data that's in a timely fashion. That's why live scan is important, so we can get this information in real time to help local officials make that decision.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, ma'am, could you, Ms. Engler, could you define what you mean as civil commitment? Because when you say that, we think only sex offenders, so... Could you define what you mean by civil commitment? And then we'd probably have to have DHS come in at some point. And I suppose that'll take place in the Health and Human Service, but find out what the missing link is there, why they aren't getting the information in. But what do you mean when you're talking civil commitments?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I believe, and counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, but Minnesota Statutes Chapter 253B provides a method for civilly committing individuals for a variety of issues, mental health, chemical dependency, mental illness. And when I say civil commitment in this context, the court, you directed the courts to send all civil commitments to NICS in 2009. So we're not talking about sex offenders. We're talking about people who are civilly committed for treatment of some kind, whether at a state facility or a private facility.
And, Mr. Chair, then
Cornish.
Our problem is that even with that, it's only going back to 2010. And so before that, there's a whole mess of information that isn't there. And then another problem we have is then when we do the stay of order and the judge allows them to go to private treatment instead of commits them, sometimes that information isn't going in either. So we've got somebody that's been adjudicated mentally ill and dangerous, but the records aren't going in for the next check, correct?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, you're correct. I believe the date was September 29th, 2010. Minnesota courts started sending civil commitment orders to NICS. One of the reasons that there's an electronic query against Department of Human Services records in Minnesota is to try to pick up some of the historical information for those individuals who are committed to the Commissioner of Human Services for treatment in a state facility. So we have some historical information available that way, but we do not have it all because we do not have all of the data for private commitments. And you are correct that if someone is there's a stay, unless courts are choosing to send that to NICS, that's going to be at the court record system.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, hopefully Representative Hillstrom and I and others will completely fix this and make it a seamless product and get all the information in a bipartisan fashion. So thank you.
Thank you. Superintendent Setter.
Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Are there any questions from members? I just want to personally thank you that the tour that you gave us the other day was really eye-opening, and you do a fantastic job. And not only do you make this state proud, but you're one of the best in the country. And again, I would encourage members who have not been there to take the tour. So thank you, and this meeting is adjourned.